Welcome to the Woodshop Life Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast focused on the craft of woodworking. I'm Sean Walker of Simple Cove, and I'm joined today by Hui Huynh of Alabama Woodworker.
How you doing?
Pretty good. And Guy Dunlap of Guy's Woodshop.
Howdy.
Duty. This podcast is intended to answer questions from the woodworking community and give you some of our perspectives on how we get things done in our own shop. But I want to mention, we also have a new Patreon account. Right now, we have one level, and we're simply asking for a small donation to just try to cover the costs of bringing you this podcast. Please visit patreon.com/woodshoplife for more information, and we sincerely hope that you will give us your support. So let's dive right into it. Hui, what's your first question?
All right. My first question is from Josh. When planning a project, what factors do you consider when deciding between ordering thicker stock, like 8/4, or laminating thinner stock to thickness? It's hard to find 8/4 white oak in my area, even though 4/4 is plentiful. Are there any rules of thumb that say never laminate X types of parts? When is it not okay to laminate? Josh, I've actually laminated boards together of various thickness, and it's pretty common practice for me because I can't always get the thickness of boards that I need. For instance, when I was making my dining room table, I laminated 8/4 material with 4/4 material. What I did was I had a reverse taper, and the taper happened on the thicker part of the material so that when it came up to the top of the leg, it ended up being about an equal amount of thickness on both sides. Some things to consider when laminating boards together is you want to try to match the end grain and color match the boards as best as possible. And this ensures that the edge grain of the boards are going to be in somewhat of the same direction, lined up or converging so that it gives you a better looking end result. If you're making square table legs or chair legs, something that you might consider is using an 1/8 inch veneer on the edge grain, and you can resaw that 1/8 inch veneer from the same board so that the show faces will all look the same. This is actually common in some of the arts and crafts furniture. Stickley was particularly used this a lot in his Morris chairs. If you're making something like a tulip pedestal base or like a cabriole leg, then obviously this technique is not going to be necessary because you're going to be making a lot of cross cuts that would go past the 1/8 inch veneer. Another thing to consider is maybe using different color glues. For instance, using Type Bond 1 and Type Bond 2 dries like a pale yellow, which is great for maple or ash. Type Bond 2 also makes a dark wood glue, and Type Bond 3 dries closer to a brown color. You can also try epoxy, which dries clear, or add some type of dye to the epoxy. But ultimately, whatever you use, you want to minimize that glue line by having perfectly flat pieces to glue up to each other. You're still going to require a minimal amount of milling in the end. Another thing to consider is to help with movement. I like to use parallel clamps and loosely clamp down along the edge grain of the boards, then come back and add clamps along the face grain of the boards. And this makes sure that the boards don't slide around as you're bearing down on the clamps. And of course, clamping calls help distribute that clamping pressure. So that's also a good idea to use when you're laminating boards to make them thicker. If you can't get your boards perfectly flat, then glue the boards together so that the warpage of the boards are opposite of each other. This way, when you're clamping down on the glued boards, it will cause them to flatten out as opposed to the entire glue up maintaining a bow. Again, the end result is to minimize the amount that you're going to have to take off during the final milling. With that, Sean, you got anything to add? Anything that I didn't sort of think of in terms of what you might want to consider when you're laminating boards together to make them thicker?
No, that's pretty good. But I will say that the first part of the question, what factors do you consider when deciding between ordering thicker stock? You know, I guess it depends on if I'm able to get that stock, you know, my local sawmill, and the price difference between 4/4 and 8/4. If it's crazy expensive, then I will laminate 4/4 to get to the 8/4. Or sometimes if I got to go 12/4, it's extremely expensive compared to just laminating 4/4 stock. And sometimes it's hard to get. So just depending on how the price difference, the availability will determine if I'm going to laminate 4/4 into 8/4 or thicker. But that's pretty much all that I've got.
I want to say it's an exponential increase between 4-quarter, 8-quarter, and 12-quarter. At least it is in my area. Is it the same for you?
Yeah.
There you go. That could be a limiting factor.
Yeah.
Guy, how about you?
You guys pretty much covered everything. I really don't have much to add, with the exception of that if you cannot find it in your area and the project is important enough where you don't feel that the lamination of 4-quarter material is going to be appropriate, go online and you can buy 8-quarter lumber. There's a couple good resources out there, like Bell Forest Products is one of them. C.R. Mooter's Paw, which is in Xenia, Ohio.
I've always wondered how you said that.
What?
The Mooter's, whatever you
said. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right.
It sounds
right.
It
just makes sense.
Yeah.
But I know how to pronounce Xenia. It's near Dayton, Ohio, and they do online sales also.
Okay.
And there's a couple other places I'm sure you could find. But myself, I've done it a number of times, and you just have to be very, very conscious of not only the grain pattern, but the grain direction. It's just like when you glue up a top, you have to make sure that all the grain is going the same way. Otherwise, you might have one board going the other way, and it'll appear darker than the other board, depending on how you look at it. Those are really the only two rules of thumb. But if you cut it from the same piece of wood and just kind of almost like book match it, it really shouldn't be an issue. You can get it where you really don't notice that it's laminated together.
Yeah. With that, Guy, I think you've got the next question.
I do, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Let me find it here. This is from Kyle. And Kyle asks, have you guys ever done a traditional French polish? And if so, how did you do it? Well, the answer to that, Kyle, is no. I've never done a traditional French polish. Have you, Hui?
I've never done a traditional French polish.
Have you, Sean?
No, I don't have the patience.
Okay. The reason I took this question is because I have seen it demonstrated several times, and I've watched countless videos on it, and I've read a bunch of different articles on it. The way French polishing works is you take a piece of cheesecloth, and you actually put the shellac inside the cheesecloth and then wrap it with a t-shirt material or something like that, a cotton cloth. And then you squirt alcohol into that little rubber or the dauber, so to speak. And you keep working it until the shellac starts to dissolve. And what you're doing is you're moving the dauber. I'm not going to say rubber because I know you don't like that word, Hui.
It's all right.
The dauber in like a figure eight motion. And you're putting on a very, very, very thin coat of shellac. As you move it in that figure eight, when it starts to drag a little bit, you can squirt some more alcohol on it. It dissolves a little bit more of the shellac, and you can keep going. This is a very, very labor intensive thing to do. You can also help cut down the friction a little bit by putting just a very small amount of boiled linseed oil on the dauber to help it move a little bit quicker. What you're doing is you're putting a thin coat of shellac on, and as you move it in that figure eight, it creates friction and it helps lay it down a little bit nicer. But it can take up to 30 to 40 coats to build up a finish. The best thing I can tell you to do, Kyle, is there's a really good video on the on YouTube on it. And I can't remember the guy's name. I apologize. I guess I should have looked it up ahead of time. But he does a very good thing on it and a video on it. And there's a couple articles in Fine Woodworking. I know Jeff Jewett wrote one that I've read before. I've also seen Alf Sharp do it.
Yeah, I was with you when Alf did that. That was super nice. It was a really nice finish.
Yeah, and he went one step further and actually put pumice stone or pumice, whatever the hell it is, on there to help do grain fill, which I thought was a really neat thing. All I can tell you, Kyle, is it's a very laborious task. And there's plenty of information out there. I haven't done it, and I'd like to try to do it. I just don't have the time, I guess. But if you have that special project, I guess it might be a good thing to try sometime. Do you guys have any thoughts on it, Sean?
No, I was going to say it's a beautiful finish. I mean, I've seen it, you know, in person with Guy when Alf did it. It was so crystal clear and just really, really looks awesome if done correctly.
It's just that it takes so much time. And I feel like if it's that special piece, well, I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong. If you screw up, I guess you sand back, right? So.
And it's a shellac finish. So if you screw up, you know, just putting another coat of shellac down over the top of it, it'll just blend into what you have there already.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually don't have a desire to try it just because I have ways of finishing that I like that seem to work for me. But again, you know, it's always good to try new things. So yeah, my attitude towards it probably will change. It's beautiful. It's absolutely gorgeous. It's just, I haven't had the time to try it.
Yeah. All right. I guess that, I hope that helps, Kyle. Sorry. I think you have the next question, Sean.
Yep. This one's from Winter Wolf Woodworking. Who came first, chicken or the egg? So in your wood shop, what comes first, jointing or planing? What's your process? In my shop, jointing comes first, followed by the planing for the most part. I say that, and I'm just going to go back before I had the combination jointer planer. From when I had the DeWalt 734 and a very, very small quarter cable benchtop jointer. Mm-hmm. I found myself using the planer and creating a sled more than I would jointing using the jointer because it was a very tiny bed and it wasn't very accurate. So I found myself using and creating sleds and shimming the board so it would no longer rock, using some hot glue to hold it in place and then running it through the planer to get a flat side, a flat reference, and then flip it over and then remove it from the board, flip it over and run it through to flatten and make the other side parallel. For the most part, I'm using the jointer followed by the planer. And my process is to joint one face, let the board set for a couple of days, and then come back, joint that face again, and then run it through the planer. Actually, let's see, I take that back. I joint and then plane the other face, and I still leave the boards thick. And then I wait a few days, come back, and then do some final milling to take it down to size for the most part. That's my process. And then again, unless I've got a super wide board, and then I bypass the jointer planer altogether and use a router sled. And I have been known to use my drum sander to flatten and slightly remove waste from a board. When I made the desk that I'm using now, the boards were pretty flat and they were really close to the thickness I wanted. So I just used the drum sander to get them down to the final thickness. I think I took off a little over a 16th. But that is my process. What about you, Hui?
I joint first and then plane as well. Something that I've seen, although I've never tried, but because I've always had a jointer, albeit a not so good jointer in the beginning years, is some folks using their table saw or their router table to joint the edges of boards for boards that aren't extremely long. And then there are other techniques of using a long straight piece, like a piece of a phenolic or plastic, and running a long board against that. So if it has a bow to it, you can put that board against the piece of phenolic, then run that across your table saw fence, and that can edge the long side of that board and essentially act as a jointer, almost like a track saw as well. And I've also seen folks using the track saw as a method for jointing. But for me, it's always jointing first and then going to the planer. And just to be a little bit more specific, I'm always face jointing before I'm edge jointing. Guy, how about you?
Kind of the same thing. Since the general school of thought is to face joint, then run it through the thickness planer, and then edge joint afterwards, because you don't know which side you're going to need for the grain direction. Mm-hmm. Since I got a helical head, I don't concern myself with that anymore. Mm-hmm. And especially now since I have the combination machine, same one you have, Sean, but with the helical head in it, I don't even look at grain direction anymore. I just pick the face that I'm going to joint, put that down, face joint it, I join an edge, then I convert the machine into a thickness planer and get it flat. And like Sean, I don't necessarily take it down to final thickness. I'll get it just so it's flat and I have three sides square. So face, face, and an edge. Mm-hmm. And then once I've got that done, I let it sit until I'm actually ready to use the part in the project. And then I'll go ahead and do the flattening process over again, then do the joinery. That way I don't have to worry about it moving. Probably the most important thing to remember when you're doing this, when you first get the board, is you have to determine where the twists are, where the cups are, and things like that. If the board is cupped over its length, you always want to put the cupped face on the bed of the joiner. Otherwise, if you put the convex side on that joiner bed, it's just going to follow it and it's still going to remain a potato chip. There's also some tricks you can do if, you know, you've got a couple spots where it's high, especially on the corners. You can press down on one side, feed the board a little through, and then press down on the other side to get rid of that rock. There are some good videos out there on it. I've done one. I know you've done one, Wee, recently.
Yep.
Sean, have you done a video on YouTube on this subject?
On milling? No, I have not.
Okay. Well, look at mine. It's the best. It's more in depth than Hui, and there's a couple things Hui did I didn't like. So, and I disagreed with. But I can't remember what they were.
Learning how to joint twisted boards is something that I found very valuable. You know, the way that I do it is I put my pads on the two corners that are touching and run it over the blade until obviously the twist is gone for the most part. That's something that I practiced often. And once you finally get that down, it's very handy.
Milling your lumber, especially if it's rough lumber, square and flat, is probably the most important skill you can have in your shop. If your stock is straight and square, it makes everything so much easier to deal with. All your joinery, your corners, things like that, they just line up. Things will just naturally come into square for you if you have, you know, flat, square stock. Mm-hmm. Milling is something I really enjoy. I know it sounds stupid, but it's almost a science, I think. Probably the most important thing to remember, especially on the joiner part, is that you always want to reference off the outfeed of the joiner. So once you get the board pushed through a little bit and you've got enough meat on the board to get some pressure on the outfeed table, that's where you need to apply your pressure. I see a lot of people all the time, you know, they're pushing the board from the back of the infeed side, and the board's just riding up, and it's not going to be flat that way. You have to, once the cut is made, you have to keep referencing it off the outfeed table. Mm. I know that sounds basic, but again, it's something I see all the time people doing, and it's like, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah, and there's nothing more frustrating than standing there and just milling away lumber on the single board because you can't get it flat, and it's all in a technique.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. It's all, there's a lot of technique involved to it.
Yeah.
So,
well, Hui, on to you. What do you got for us?
Man, we're moving right along. What bandsaw blades are you guys running for everyday use? I've mainly used Timberwolf blades, 3/4 inch, 3 TPI for resaw, 1/4 inch, 6 TPI for general purpose, 3/16, 10 TPI for fine work. Not surprisingly, I hate changing blades. Wondering if I could at least get away with a decent compromise between resaw and general purpose. And that's from Sunrise Woodshop. Well, I'm running a 3/4 inch 3 TPI blade for resawing and a 1/2 inch 4 TPI blade for general purpose. And I pretty much keep the 1/2 inch 4 TPI blade on my bandsaw about 75% of the time. The 1/2 inch 4 TPI blade is good enough for a majority of my resaw cuts, which is mostly 8 inches or less in resaw height. I don't have issues with blade drift because I'm giving a nice, slow, but consistent feed rate. And if I feed the material too fast, the blade doesn't have enough time to clear out the sawdust. So I try to keep it a nice, slow, consistent feed rate. A blade with fewer gullets is going to offer more space for the sawdust to be extracted from the cut. And I feel like a half inch 4 TPI blade gives me enough cut capacity and enough of a tooth count for a majority of my resawing and a majority of my curve work, because I'm not really making a lot of like really large, like tight curves on a lot of the, on the things that I'm using. Is it the best for resawing and is it the best for curve work? No, but I'm usually going to the spindle sander or the disc sander or the belt sander or the drum sander afterwards to clean up my cuts. And, you know, I don't have a need for a smaller blade at the moment. I have the 3/4 inch 3 TPI blade for resawing over 8 inches in resaw height. And that also works very well, but it's just not a blade that I would leave on my bandsaw because of its curve cutting limitations. But that's pretty much what I have. And Guy, what are you using? And do you have anything to add?
Listening to your answer, I've got a question for you, Hui.
Okay.
Why do you feel the 3/4 inch blade is going to give you better resaw than the 1/2 inch blade? Is it the difference between the 3 and the 4 TPI, or is it the width of the blade?
Did I say that the 1/2 inch gives me a better resaw capacity?
No, cut? You said anytime I go over 6 or 7 inches, you use the 3/4 inch.
With the 3/4 inch blade, I've got a little bit, the width helps keep the blade straight. And then on top of that, the 3 TPI, it's a deeper gullet. And so it's extracting more sawdust and giving the blade time to extract the sawdust versus having another tooth right behind it to then cut and bog down on the saw. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. The only thing I disagree with on that, I'm going to play devil's advocate here.
All right.
It doesn't matter how wide your blade is. It's irrelevant. If your saw is tuned right, it doesn't matter. What does matter is the tooth per inch for resaw.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's actually 2 TPI blades out there, not that common, but a 3 TPI blade is very common. What I had for years on my saw, I had one blade on it, and that was a 3/8 inch 3 TPI blade, and it did everything I needed it to. There was sometimes I needed to do like scroll work and stuff like that, in which case I used a 3/16 10 TPI. It might actually be a 14 TPI blade for finer work because it requires less sanding, but you have to go slow. But the width of the blade shouldn't really matter for resaw. If you want to getting to Mr. Sunrise's question, I would recommend for a good general purpose blade is a 3/8 inch 3 TPI blade. Mm-hmm. That'll get you 99% of what you need. Myself, I keep a 3/4 inch 3 TPI carbide tipped on my bandsaw 100% of the time because I have 2 bandsaws. So I've got a I've got a smaller bandsaw with the 3/16 inch blade on it that I use for curved work if I need something like that.
So let me ask you this. What is the benefit then? Why make a 3/4 inch blade? Because I always thought that it was it offered more of a straighter cut.
I think the logic behind it is that it's thicker and it's going to be less prone to belly.
Ah, yes. Okay.
But if your saw is set up properly, you shouldn't have a problem with belly. And even if you don't have a carbide tooth blade, resawing, kind of like doing a four-squaring lumber, there's a science and an art to it. And it all depends on your bandsaw blade, the setup. More important than anything else is your feed rate. So you have to get all three of those things right. And just after you do it for a while, you just kind of get the hang of it. But like I said, getting back to the question, I think that if it were me and I can only have one blade on my bandsaw, it would be a 3/8 inch 3 TPI blade. What do you think, Sean?
I only keep one blade on my saw year round until it goes dull. And that's a 3/4, 3 TPI Timberwolf. If I cut curves that are decently sharp, I will just make relief cuts. But I just keep 3/4, 3 TPI on the bandsaw year round until it's dull. Then I'll throw it away and get another one.
Yeah, I bought into that whole thing of you got to have multiple blades specifically for specific things. And then I've just kept the 1/2 inch 4 TPI on there. And just one day I was just like, well, I don't feel like changing it. Let me just see if I can resaw all right with this blade. And sure enough, I resawed fine with it.
Yeah.
It tracks exactly the same as it does with a 3/4 inch 3 TPI. I don't have tracking issues.
Now, I can't remember who I was talking to, but they got the same bandsaw I do. Anyways, it'll take up to a 1 inch.
Mm-hmm.
And he got a 1 inch and he was having all kinds of problems with it. I'm like, why'd you get a 1 inch? He goes, well, I figured could take a 1 inch. So I did. I'm like, well, I understand that go big, go home kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
For resawing, what really matters is the TPI. Mm-hmm. You have to have a low TPI so the sawdust can get extracted from the wood, because that's what will also cause, you know, if that thing gets packed up with wood and you can't get the chips extracted fast enough,
mm-hmm.
that's when you're going to have bellying or bowing of the blade. That's going to cause a lot of it. So,
and that's where feed rate also is something to consider, right?
Correct. Yeah. So if you have like a 4 TPI blade, or I know there's some, you know, 6 and 8s out there too, just move it at a slower rate.
Yep.
And it'll be fine.
Yep. All right. I think, Guy, you're next, right?
Am I?
Yeah.
Am I up again?
Sure, yep, are.
You're up again.
This is from Tyler at the Hubble Wood Shop. 2 weeks in a row. You owe me $10, Tyler. He says he's got a new question for us, which is good. Blade cleaning versus blade sharpening. We all know it's a good practice to clean the blades regularly, and personally, I go with some warm water and Simple Green. That's a pretty good way to do it,
mm-hmm.
and it's worked great for me. My question is, what are the signs I should look for when I'm beyond the simple solution and it's time to get my blades sharpened? Well, the answer to that is when they're dull.
Next.
Moving on. A good indication of your blade is dull, I mean, when you have to, especially like on your table saw, you have to, you know, you can hear the motor kind of straining a little bit and you have to push the wood a little bit slower because it just isn't cutting as fast. Or you get burn marks, things like that. Typically, you know, unless you're in a production shop, good carbide tipped blade should last you well over a year. I know guys that have gone a couple years without them being sharpened. As far as a bandsaw goes, you'll know when it's dull because it won't track straight anymore. It'll just go all wonky on you. That's a pretty good indication. You're trying to cut a straight line, all of a sudden it'll go to the left or the right. Router bits, you know, you'll get burning, things like that. Burning is a pretty good indicator. On a table saw too, you can look at, when you make a cut, you can take a look at the mill marks left by the blade. And if they're pretty exaggerated and you can see them mm-hmm. pretty good, that's also a very good indication of it may be time to go get the blade sharpened. Now, I keep in my table saw a 40-tooth combination Forest Woodworker 2. And I have two of those blades. I keep one in the table saw and I keep one brand new and sharpened up on a cabinet shelf. And once a year, actually, I'm due about right now, but at the beginning of the year, in January, I'll box that one up on my table saw and I'll send it back for sharpening, even if it doesn't need it. Now, when they, especially Forest is very good because they'll also replace teeth, things like that. They'll also make sure it's sharpening at the correct 1/8 of an inch. Too many sharpenings and your blade will actually get skinnier.
Mm-hmm.
And they've actually, last time I sent it in, I think they replaced like 4 or 5 teeth. It's a very good service, but that one blade is, I want to say 20 years old, and the other one's about 10 years old. So mm-hmm. I've had them for a very long time. Typically, cleaning your blades is going to help tremendously, mm-hmm. Especially router bits. Router bits typically don't see enough use in their lifetime to get really dull. They just need to get the pitch cleaned off of them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. How do you feel about that, Sean?
You know, speaking about the router bits, I think that's something that I often overlook is clean the router bits. they get dirty too, instead of just tossing them when they burn or smoke or don't cut clean. I often forget to clean the router bits. That's really important. In the beginning of my woodworking career, I would get cheaper blades, and when they would get dull and clean them and still be dull, I would just toss them. Until a couple of years ago, I got a really good Freud blade, and I was getting close to needing to send it off to get it cleaned until I triggered the cartridge on my saw stop. So that led me to buy, what is it called, a Ridge carbide blade. Mm-hmm. This is a good blade. It was a decently expensive blade that I will be sending off to get cleaned. I haven't had the need to yet.
But send it off to get cleaned or sharpened?
I'm sorry, sharpened. Yeah.
Okay. I was going to say,
sure, that wow, I can handle that.
Money to burn there.
Yeah. Mr. I don't Big have time Bucks to clean my blades. But yeah, sharpen. I'm glad you corrected that.
I've got people to do that for me.
Wow. Yeah. I'm glad you caught me on that.
Well, you said it twice. Otherwise, I wouldn't have said anything.
Yeah. Sharpened. Yeah. You know, if you don't have a, what was the brand that you had again, Guy?
Forest.
Will they sharpen blades other than a Forest branded blade?
Yes. But since it's not a Forest, they'll sharpen it wrong just to screw with you.
Okay. So
no, I'm just kidding. No, they'll sharpen anything.
Okay.
They're very good.
So that's a resource if you're interested in where to send it. My local Woodcraft also sharpens blades. They have a service, and I don't know, they may clean them too. So you may want to ask them, but I'm just joking. That's all I've got on that. I've not had to just yet, but Hui, what about you?
So I get my table saw blade sharpened, and I do it once a year, but I'm in the same boat as you, Guy. I have two of the same blade. One is always on deck, ready to go, just in case something happens, and the other one is in my table saw. And at the end of the year, I take one out, I package it up, I give it to my sharpening guy in town. He's also able to replace teeth, although he hasn't had to replace any of the teeth on my table saw blades yet because they're relatively new. And then I put the new one in, and that's ready to go for another year or until I remember to switch them out.
Now, if you didn't do that, how would you know when it needs to be sharpened?
Burning, fuzzies at the top and bottom of the cut. If it's not giving me a clean cut, I'm usually able to tell. The ridge marks along the cut, my miter slot and my table saw fence are pretty parallel to the blade. So if I'm noticing a lot of ridge marks along the cut line, then it's probably a sign that either I need to clean the blade or I need to sharpen it. Now, after I clean the blade, if I'm still getting the same result, then I got to go and get it sharpened. But usually what I'll do is I'll clean it first. But I'm pretty regular about cleaning my blades. Usually about every beginning of every project, I just go ahead and just clean my blade. I have a little bucket that I just, or a 5-gallon Homer bucket that I put a little bit of purple power, which is essentially simple green, and water in just to cover the bottom of the bucket, and place my blade in there. And 5 minutes later, I scrub it off, dry it off, and put it on. So I'm pretty consistent about doing that regularly. So I'm able to tell when the blade is dull. The thing is that I usually don't get to the point where the blade is dull, because for me to sharpen my blade is, I think it's like $12 was the last time I got it done. And
that's cheap.
It's a local guy, and he does everybody's table saw blades in town. He's like the only guy that does it. What?
Everybody's?
Everybody in town. No, I'm literally not kidding you. When I went in there, he's got like hundreds of blades just lined up.
Okay.
You know, yeah, he's the only guy in town that does it. Everybody else has to send them. You know, if you don't go to that guy, you're sending it off.
Yeah.
And so he's sort of got a monopoly on blade sharpening. But that being said, he doesn't charge a lot. I mean, $12 for a blade is pretty good.
Will he do bandsaw blades too?
He doesn't do bandsaw blades. I asked him about that.
So is it like a machine shop, or is it that's all he does is sharpen table saw blades?
He does table saw blades, he does chainsaw blades, and he does router bits and shaper bits. But he's got the whole setup where the tool, he puts it in his machine, and it basically goes up and down and rotates the blade and goes up and down and sets the angle. He can change the angle. You know, he can do a flat grind if you want. He can do you know, all different types of table saw blades, radial arm saws, swing arm mill saws and stuff like that. He's doing all of it. Normally, I'm not letting my blade get dull enough to to really know if it needs to be sharpened, to be honest. Now I think about it, I just sharpen that blade every year or so.
I mean, probably is not dull after a year use in my shop.
No, me neither.
It's just something I do as far as general maintenance goes. Now, I remember a time way back when the table saw blades were just high-speed steel and the router bits were the same way.
I don't remember those times.
I do, especially the router bits. Less expensive. There was carbide router bits, but they were really, you know, they're like, you know, $70-$80 a piece. And this was 25-30 years ago. And the bulk of what you would find was high speed steel, and they would just dull really fast. And it's like, you know, it would drive you nuts. There was a couple sharpening services in town that did it. There's probably somebody here in town that does it, but I just haven't bothered. I just send them back to the manufacturer. I probably pay way too much, but, you know, it is what it is.
When I first started, I was using thin kerf blades. And when I went to a full kerf blade, oh my goodness, so much better. I'd never go back to a thin kerf blade. I got so much deflection and it was always hard to, how thick is this blade again? How do I calculate for this thickness?
You know what? When I want to use a thin kerf blade in my saw, you know what I do? I use a 7 1/4 inch blade.
Oh, like a what do you call it?
Circular saw blade.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're cheap. Mm-hmm. You know, they're like $8. You get three of them. Mm-hmm. Carbide tipped. They're fine. I use those things all the time.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
For cutting thin stock or where I don't want to lose a lot of material.
Cutting splines.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I think the last question's on me, so let me go ahead and dive into that. This is from RJ. Hey guys, wondering if you can recommend a table saw for me outside of a larger cabinet saw. Space is limited for me, and being able to move it around my workshop is key. I own a track saw for breaking down sheet goods, but am lacking a saw to rip thinner pieces consistently. I like something with a good fence and miter slots to use some jigs that I will make. Thanks for any help you may have. Well, I don't have a whole lot of experience with job site saws, which I'm guessing this is kind of what you're wanting to look at. But I did do some research and I found an article that I'll link to that goes into like a crazy in-depth review of 8 different job site saws. You know, there's some really good options out there and they cover precision and accuracy, performance, price, and ergonomics. And believe it or not, they picked the Hitachi C10 RJ as the winner. And, you know, that's a saw with a max cut to the right of the blade of 35 inches. It can support a dado of 13/16. Another couple that they picked were a DeWalt DWE 749 1RS and a Makita 2705X1. And these are all job site saws that have a mobile base so you can move it around. It's got pretty good capacity, and they really liked the Hitachi and the DeWalt's rack and pinion fence. But this article, if you're interested in a smaller job site saw that's accurate and will last you a while, I will link to this in the show notes for you to check out, because like I was saying, they went over 8 different models and covered all kinds of different points as far as grading these saws. I will link to that in the show notes, but they picked the Hitachi as the winner, and it was mainly due to the price. Now they had the saw stop job site saw in here, but unfortunately due to the price of it, it got dinged pretty hard.
So. Yeah, but it's worth it because if you don't pay that price, you're going to die.
Yeah. If price wasn't a consideration,
wasn't consideration.
Yeah. Well, you know, if price wasn't a consideration, I'm pretty sure that the saw stop, I think, would have been in the top 3. Because the precision accuracy, it came in first, but what really got it was the price. Obviously dead last with it being 3 times the price of the Hitachi saw alone.
It's almost $1,000, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good saw.
Oh yeah, I bet it is.
Did they mention anything about the fence? Cause I've used a couple of job site saws and I hated the fence.
Well, they mentioned on the Hitachi and the DeWalt, they have the rack and pinion fence, and they like that out of all 8 or 9 of them. They like those 2 the best, that style of fence. held its place pretty well, didn't deflect and whatnot. But I recommend if you have a Home Depot or Lowe's or any other place like that, just go in there and check out a couple of these. I'm pretty sure they're going to have the DeWalt and a Rigid and a Bosch. You know, go check a few of these out. I'll link to this in the show notes. But the clear winner to them was the Hitachi, followed by, I think, the DeWalt and a skill saw. Mm. What about you guys? Do you guys have any experience with any of these job site saws in the past, I don't know, 10, 15 years?
I have never used one. I've seen them, but I've never used them. My son actually has the DeWalt, and he likes it. It's perfect for him. If his RJ's question is, you know, I can't have a larger cabinet saw and space is limited, I really don't know. I would imagine like a contractor saw on a mobile base is going to have a larger footprint than a job site saw on a mobile base, but I'm not quite sure how much. So that's something to consider too. Unless you're putting the job site saw on like a cart or something like that, where it doesn't have the, you know, like the collapsible.
Yeah, the wheel stand.
Yep.
Yeah, the wheel stand, stuff like that. That's something to consider too, because there's some very good contractor saws out there also that are every bit as good as a full-size cabinet saw. They're just a lot less expensive. I mean, that's what you had for a long time, right, Sean? Or you had a hybrid?
Yeah, correct. But it was pretty much a contractor's type saw.
I had a contractor saw for years, and it was fine.
Absolutely.
Think about, don't think that, you know, this one's smaller. Think how much smaller. Is an extra 6 inches over here worth getting a small plastic saw with a universal motor versus something with a decent induction motor and a decent fence and a cast iron top? That would be first thing I would think of. But like I said, I've never used one, so I couldn't comment either way on what's good and what isn't. Like I said, my son has the DeWalt and he seems to really like it.
Depends on how much you're going to be moving it around too, because weight could become a factor, even though it's a mobile base. Are you going to take it anywhere? But yeah, mobile bases cure all of that.
I've used the Bosch contractor saw, or excuse me, Bosch job site saw and a Skill job site saw, the brand Skill. And I hated the fence on both of them. They were, I hated it. I mean, I was
the experience not good. Don't sugarcoat it.
The problem is that you would move the fence, and because they're not a Biesmeyer style fence, they would seem as though they were where they were supposed to be, but then they would shift and jostle as you were clamping down. And that was my biggest complaint, really.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's a job site saw. I mean, it needs to be mobile. It needs to be able to be picked up from, you know, a truck and then put down on a work surface. So they have to be as light as possible. And a Biesmeyer fence with the steel tubes and whatnot, then that's not light. But if you're not planning on moving it, as in lifting it up, I really do think a contractor's saw is not that much bigger in footprint.
Not on a cart.
No.
Not on one of the mobile job site carts.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
I'd be interested to know exactly what the size difference is in footprint, because you're absolutely right. You know, getting us, that's the other thing on a contractor saw. There's a lot of good ones out there mm-hmm. that have the T-style Biesmeyer fence on mm-hmm. it.
And getting that solid cast iron top, that's great to reference off of, that you don't only use it for a table saw. I mean, I use my table saw top for a lot of different things because it's just a perfectly flat, hard, solid surface to use. So just things to consider there.
Yeah. And it all depends on how much room you have. One thing about a job site saw, I know that it's a smaller, like the table's smaller, is the fence can go in and out. Like the extension fence can go in. It just all depends on how much room you have. If you have enough room, go contractor saw. If you have to get a job site saw and you don't have that much room, I'll link to this so you can go check out some of the reviews and see what you think.
Yeah, even then, you know, a full-size cabinet saw takes about the same footprint as a contractor saw.
Yeah. Well, I guess that'll do it for this show. Please remember, this podcast is here to answer your questions from the woodworking community. So if you have woodworking questions you would like answered, you can send them through the podcast contact page at woodshoplifepodcast.com, Or don't forget, you can DM us through Instagram at Woodshop Life. We'd also like to thank everyone who left us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps us in search rankings. And of course, we truly appreciate the support and feedback. And you can reach me at simplecove.com and at simplecove on Instagram and YouTube. And where can you be found, Hui?
You can find me at alabamawoodworker.com. All the links to my social media sites are there. Guy, where can we find you?
Guyswoodshop.com.
Awesome. Thanks for listening, guys. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Hey, have a good
Talk
night.
Talk to you.